Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. You're likely aware that in the last 2 years, at least 7 rural hospitals have closed in Oklahoma. Fewer hospitals means fewer physicians for those that live in rural areas, which comprise 1/3 of Oklahoma's population. It takes a special kind of doctor to practice in a small town farther from the whistles and bells of modern medicine. My guest today, Dr. Ayaz Virgi, is one such person. He's a family doctor who moved his wife and 3 children to the town of Dawson, Minnesota, population 1,500. Dr. Virgi and his family were welcomed with open arms when they chose to make Dawson their home in 2014. But things started changing in 2016 as the country was engaged in a divisive election. The county that Dawson sits in voted 65% for Donald Trump, including many of Virgi's friends and coworkers, which was to his great surprise. Ayaz Virgi began experiencing more negativity about his religion, Islam, and the color of his skin, which is brown. He was invited by a local pastor to give a talk on the nature of Islam, in which he focused on 3 key issues he knew his audience wanted to hear about: terrorism, Sharia law, and the role of women. Reluctant at first, Virgi embraced the opportunity and helped educate his townsfolk and build bridges of understanding among people of different faiths and across different communities. He's taken the talk around the region and now the country, as he's just written a new book called Love Thy Neighbor, A Muslim Doctor's Struggle for Home in Rural America. Ayaz Virgi is a family doctor with a subspecialty in managing obesity. In addition to his work on tolerance and comparative religion, he holds a patent for a product called Body Togs that provides ergonomic leg or arm weight to wear throughout your regular day and help burn more calories. He's successfully implemented it into medical practice. Dr. Ayaz Virgi of Dawson, Minnesota and New York University Abu Dhabi is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Ayaz Virgi, welcome to Medical Monday. I want to just start by asking a little bit about your career trajectory. So you wound up in Dawson, Minnesota, which is really the scene of your book, but take us back to sort of how you became a doctor and how you wound up in Dawson.
Sure. First, thanks for having me on, John. It's a pleasure to be here. So I've been in practice for 17 years as a family physician and also board certified as an obesity medicine specialist. And so about 5 years ago, I was mid-career and practicing in a large hospital system in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, very happy, doing well. I had a leadership position, making lots of money, what have you. And it just felt like I wanted more for my career. And, you know, I've worked in free clinics my entire career. I worked when I was a Georgetown medical student. I helped co-found the community medical clinic in Herndon, Virginia. When I was a resident at Duke, I worked at the Urban Ministries Free Clinic and the Red Crescent Free Clinic in Florida. And so for me, it was I needed more out of medicine beyond just what I was doing. And we have such a paucity of, you know, doctors and medical services in rural America, and we have 20% of the population, but only 9% of the physicians. And critical access hospitals are closing, you know, left and right. So I felt like I wanted to do something about this. And then also, I kind of wanted to get out of the turnstile medicine, a little bit of the corporatocracy, which we've, you know, the volume of patients versus kind of quality care. So I wanted to do both of those things, and that's what led me to leave a very lucrative position in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and then take this, you know, rural medicine position in Dawson, Minnesota, a town of 1,500.
How did your Harrisburg colleagues react to your decision to leave what seemed like a successful position and lucrative job? I mean, that must have been strange.
Yeah, I would say shock defines it probably the best. And it's really funny because I had a leadership position there, and I actually came to Johnson Memorial Health Services in Dawson as chief of staff and medical director. And, you know, my job was more than just a physician, but to help the organization thrive. And since I've been there, we've developed multiple service lines. We've got recruited many doctors. We're just a thriving organization now. But the chief operating officer called me twice after I left. The first was in the first few months and said, listen, have you gotten this, you know, rural medicine thing out of your system? Are you ready to come back? And I said, you know, no, I appreciate it. I'm flattered that you want me to come back, but I really am happy here, and this is where I belong. And then a year later, she calls me again and says, you know what, we just merged with a larger hospital system. We can, you know, pay you even more. We can negotiate financially. You know, what do you say about coming back? And I said, listen, I appreciate it. I'm flattered, but I am where I need to be.
You point out that, well, rural America is a wide swath and maybe not as much of the population anymore as we've become an urban country with people living in cities more than in rural areas. But you could have really thrown a dart at the map and landed anywhere. What was it about Minnesota?
I'd gotten a postcard in the mail from a recruiter, and that's really where it started. And I guess, you know, we get these as physicians all the time, but then this enticed me because it was really, you know, a practice where I could be practice, you know, comprehensive primary care and the dignified medicine that I wanted to, where I could see the patient in the ER, in the outpatient center, in the hospital, in the nursing home, and you know, it just felt like a good fit. We did have family in Minneapolis, which is about 3 hours away, but that's really how I came across Dawson.
So the nature of your book, let's get into this. It's called Love Thy Neighbor, A Muslim Doctor's Struggle for Home in Rural America. And you, as you point out, make this decision to move yourself and your family with three children and a wife to Dawson, Minnesota, population 1,500. And things go pretty well at first. But then, well, I'll let you tell it. I mean, things sort of take a turn for the worse with the 2016 election. So,
yeah, no, it is really interesting, the dynamics of what happened. You know, when we first moved, I mean, we were so happy and still are happy with the people here. They're so gracious and kind. And, you know, the first couple years, I mean, we had no difficulty blending in. We had no difficulty with finding friends and feeling comfortable. I mean, we almost felt like it was our own little fairy tale where we met so many people and it was such a pleasant experience. But after November 8th, 2016, things definitely changed. They changed for us. And it was weird because, you know, we all know that the president used a lot of fear mongering and hate to get elected. And that works. That's worked for many decades. But he just was very good at it. And he said things like, all Muslims belong on a registry and we need to ban Muslims. And I mean, that was just, that was crazy because, you know, here I am. I didn't come to rural America because I had to. I came because I wanted to. I wanted to do something. And then all of a sudden, I'm hearing my neighbors say things like, well, you know, the Virgies, they shouldn't be allowed to put up Christmas decorations because they don't worship Jesus. And it's like, well, we've done Christmas our entire life. You know, it's part of our culture. Why would you bring that up now? Or, you know, we used to babysit Pastor Mandy's daughter, Miriam, when she was 9 months old so that Mandy could give the sermons during Lent. And people would ask Mandy, hey, aren't you scared that the Virgies are going to convert your daughter? How can you leave them with them? And it's like, really? A nine-month-old? You know, if a nine-month-old understands God and the cosmos and what have you, then I would be learning something from her, not vice versa. And just those types of things. And then even when we decided we would do our first lecture, people protested here. They protested that a Muslim shouldn't be allowed to speak publicly. And I was like, what are you talking about? Where was this when I first decided to move here? Why didn't you tell me that that's what was in your heart? Because I just wouldn't have come. You know, I didn't come to talk about my religion or to educate. I came to fill a void as far as healthcare goes. And now all of a sudden I'm seeing this type of, you know, attitude towards us because we're brown, because we're Muslim. So it was almost a dichotomy in my own self-identity because it was like, you know, if you could take the MD out of me and keep it here and, you know, take care of, you know, this critical access area that needs it, but then take the brown Muslim part of me and put it on a registry and ship it away, you would. And that's how I felt.
So when you made the decision to move there, people were very welcoming, obviously, to have a doctor in town or a new doctor in town. And then suddenly sort of the rhetoric around the election just unleashed this, I guess, latent, for lack of a better word, racism or, you know, anti-Muslim fervor. And I mean, I'm shocked. I mean, some of these things were in the book, but some weren't. Like, I don't know if I remember reading a thing about Mandy. So we should talk about who Mandy is as a character in the book. She's a very important person. And as you mentioned, she was a, I guess, a student pastor and was giving sermons at one of the local churches. And so you, I guess, became friends with her, or you, as you said, your family was babysitting. And so she came to you with her proposal.
Yeah. Clearly, after the election, we were upset. I was upset. I was angry. I was ready to go. I was like, you know, forget this. I just want to leave. I'll leave the country and, you know, live with my family in Dubai. But Mandy came to us and said, you know, let's do something here. Let's do something positive. Let's educate. Let's talk to people. Let's start the conversation. And I was very hesitant at first. I didn't want to. And then after a few days, you know, I think my anger calmed down. And I said, you know what? She's right. We should do something. So I really give full credit to Mandy for kind of starting this movement with the lectures, which have kind of culminated into us doing about 25 of these so far now. But, you know, and she's a Caucasian, you know, Christian pastor. She doesn't have any skin in this game, but she's actually living the love thy neighbor theme, the love thy neighbor commandment, in that she was as, you know, offended or more offended that we were going through this than even we were. And that was really touching. That was really enlightening. And that made me feel again that, you know, I really should do this. And it went back to the idea of the reason I came to Dawson in the first place. If not me, then who? Who's going to do it? You know, and I could complain all day or I could go out and do something. And Mandy herself has been, you know, subject to some derogation as well. She's been called a closet Muslim, meaning that she's not a real Christian. And I remember when she was being called that, she called me and she was in tears saying, you know, how can people say this? And I was like, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry that this is happening to you. And I remember one time somebody after her sermon took some, like, bacon, you know, because Muslims don't eat pork, and just smeared it on her windshield, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
And that was after giving a sermon at church. And it's like, how can this happen? I mean, what are people thinking, you know? Hmm. But these are all events that happened.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Ayaz Virgi, who is a family doctor in Dawson, Minnesota, where he is speaking to us from. He's the author of the new book, Love Thy Neighbor, and it's a memoir of his struggle to find home in rural America, Dawson, Minnesota, population 1,500, where he took his family, his wife and three children, and became really the town doctor, where he also specializes in obesity and built up a pretty huge clinical presence where I guess it was, how long was the wait list when you built it up? Was it 6 weeks or 6 months for someone to get an appointment with you?
Yeah, it's about 3 months now for patients to get into the obesity clinic.
Wow. But so let's go back to the key element here. So Mandy, as you point out, is living this life, this Christian value of love thy neighbor, this universal value really, and invites you to give a talk in church. And I think one of the humorous parts of the book is you throw yourself into this, right? And so you write out, I guess, longhand, some dozens of pages. And I guess the first draft, let's just say, didn't go over real well with your audience. Can you tell us about that and what happened?
Yeah, so this was the night before we were to give the talk, and then Mandy came over, and Masar, my wife, was there, and we actually had a student, medical student with us at that time, too, and so I was just kind of giving a practice run. I was really proud of this, because I'd put like 20, 30 hours in putting this together. I got really philosophical, talking about the different aspects of jurisprudence and what have you as far as Islam and what it actually is, and I remember after giving it, both like Mandy and Masar, their jaws just hit the floor. They're like, you cannot give that lecture, okay? You will have lost everybody in the crowd. They don't want to hear about the theoretical practices. They don't want to hear about, you know, the theophany and what have you. They want to hear three things. They want to hear women, they want to hear Sharia, and they want to hear terrorism. You got to talk about that. So then I remember after that, I was like, you know what, you're right. This is way too academic. So then I went back upstairs and I think it was like 6 hours or so later, I just freehanded all of this onto a legal notepad. And that was it. That was the lecture.
And it was a hit. I mean, the second draft really, you got excellent advice from your beta testers or your initial audience.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's like a true true doctor or medical student making a very academic, probably, you know, your PowerPoint or whatever, like going into the theory and everything, the pedagogy. But then you hit the points that they mentioned. It's certainly Mandy, and it sounds like your wife really knew what the audience was going to want to hear. And what's great about the book, the structure of the book, is like each chapter becomes sort of one of these topics that you tackle in the talk. So you point out that you are able to sort of, you know, look up at various times and see that the audience is really with you on this. And so it's sort of a happy part of the book, I think. And you point out, too, that there are, I think it was 400 people or something, so it's like a quarter of the town comes to hear this thing. So even though initially there's some reticence and reluctance that you shouldn't even be given the floor. I mean, I think that better heads prevail and they say, hey, like, give the guy a chance to talk. Is that sort of right?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of support, and that evinced itself in the turnout for the talk. And we did have a lot of people after the talk coming to us and saying, thank you, and, you know, you've opened our eyes. And, you know, that really felt good. That definitely made it worthwhile. And then all of a sudden after that, all the invitations start coming for other towns and even colleges and academic centers and things of that sort.
Yeah, so there are a few surprises there. Like, I guess on the one hand, people get wind of this and think, wow, you know, a guy out here preaching tolerance, love thy neighbor, a nice Christian-Muslim interfaith dialogue. And that really wasn't always the case. Like, there was one of your neighboring towns where things just really didn't go well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the next talk, when I was giving the talk, somebody stood up and said, you know, it doesn't matter what you do, you're the Antichrist because of what you believe. And I said, really? That's terrible to think that. And I said, so nothing I've done matters. So none of the work I've done in free clinics, or not even the rationale for me coming to Dawson to help, matters. It's just what you believe. It's just what you say you believe. And I said, okay, if that's the case, then that must mean that Hitler, who, you know, killed millions of Jews in order to help purify the Aryan race for God because he was a Christian, is in heaven right now, enjoying salvation, whereas Gandhi, who was one of the most, you know, peaceful men of the 20th century, who preached, you know, I am no religion, but I'm all religion, is burning in hell right now. So therefore, you must have more in common with Hitler than you do me. And so he was aghast at me saying that. But then I was like, well, I'm just taking your logic to the natural conclusion, which is, you know, if indeed you felt that, then you're negating the vast majority of your own religion, because in James 2:12 it tells us faith without deeds is nothing. In 1 John it says, you know, my children, let our love not just be words and talk, it must be true love which manifests in deeds. And you're just taking a fraction of your religion and over exemplifying it to represent something that it's not. And, you know, that was a surprise. And what I also found surprising was people in other talks who were telling me, like, well, you don't know your religion. You gotta go learn it. You know, what you're telling is not Islam. And I'm like, really? So who should teach me? You should teach me, you know, or ISIS should teach me. So is it fair to look at what, you know, 0.01% of Muslims in the world, which is what they represent, these terrorists, these monsters, you know, because if you look at the State Department country report on terrorism, you know, you have 1.6 billion Muslims in the world, and you have a total of, with all the 53, you know, terrorist organizations, maximum of 200,000 involved in terrorism. That's 0.01% of the Muslim population. So is it fair to take them and then just say, okay, what they say represents Islam? Because that's not fair. That's not what I believe. I condemn that categorically. That would be like me going to Christians and saying, well, the KKK and Jim Jones and Joseph Kony, who is, you know, the world's largest Christian terrorist, and he's killed over 10,000 people in the name of God, in the name of Jesus, is representative of Christianity. And that wouldn't be right. But that's kind of what we're up against.
Those are excellent counterexamples. You know, one of the rhetorical things you use in the talk that I found really powerful was you essentially do some crowd questions and say, I'm going to read you a verse, and you tell me whether this is from the Bible or the Quran. And I guess I wasn't all that surprised, but you would read a phrase, and I would have no idea where it was from, being pretty poorly schooled in religion. But give a couple of examples where it was sort of surprising, where, of course, people would think, oh, this is in the Christian Bible, and it turned out it was in the Quran, and you would think something a little more aggressive or violent was in the Quran, but it was actually in the Christian Bible.
Sure. So, on account of the angels, a woman should have a covering over her head to show she is under her husband's authority.
Yeah, so that's, definitely sounds Quran, we would guess, right?
Yeah, yeah. So that's 1 Corinthians 11:10. So that's not even Old Testament. That's New Testament. So you would think that the head covering, because we see women in Islam covering their hair, but that doesn't actually come from the Quran. That comes from the Hadith, and that comes from, you know, have you ever seen a picture of the Virgin Mary without her hair covered? I mean, that's something that we venerate her. And it's funny how, you know, Paul says this about women. He says it also later in 1 Corinthians that any woman who doesn't cover her hair when praying, you should shave her head, because it's ignominious to actually be outside with your hair uncovered. Now, we don't have that in the Quran. You know, the Quran isn't a clothing manual. The Quran is a book of principles, and then we try to take these abstract principles and put something tangible by combining, you know, the Quran with the prophet's life. But that's an example of one that everyone got wrong. Another one was Matthew 5:30, where Jesus says directly, if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is much better for you to lose one of your limbs than your whole body to go to hell. That's not Quran. That's the Bible. Now, obviously, Jesus, who was the most peaceful man in existence, wasn't trying to be taken literally. He was talking specifically about, you know, the afterlife being far more important than this life. So when it comes to looking at verses that are visceral in the Quran, and there are visceral verses like this in the Quran, they're also not meant to be taken literally. They're taken figuratively, and you have to have amount of reflection and application in order to do that. So the same standards that you look at the Bible, you should look at the Quran, you know. So if we are going to just be very literal like the extremists are, then you have to do the same thing with the Bible. You can't just do it with one or the other.
A couple more things about the book. So it gets very constricted. I mean, you point out that after the election, you're in a little bit of a tailspin and angry. And at least as you write it, you really were serious about leaving the country, just because you were so frustrated to find out that it turned out all of these people you'd been living among for 2 or 3 years seemed to have, well, for a lot of different reasons, though, actually, right? So a lot of it was, it seemed like anti-Hillary Clinton voting. But of course, it was hard for you emotionally to sort of give a pass on that. It was just like, you know, you're voting for Trump, you're voting for Trump. And it's you're voting essentially against me as your town's doctor and as your friend, your colleague. And that was hurtful. There were other, as I understand it, have been subject to death threats and all other kinds of hatred. Is that right?
Yeah, that's been unfortunate. Who would have thought that preaching love would be so dangerous?
Yeah.
But yeah, that's happened. And, you know, what you said is exactly right. You know, I was angry, and it's not right to be angry. And I've said a lot of things also that I regret, too. You know, but to me, it was a package deal. I mean, Donald Trump, he said things literally. He didn't disguise it. He said it. You know, he said all Muslims should be on a registry. He said, I want, you know, to put a ban on Muslims. I mean, you're throwing out the baby with the bathwater, and you have to own that. He said things like, punch the guy in the face, I'll pay your legal fees. Or he made fun of a disabled reporter. Now, when I look at that, it's like any candidate in the world, any party, I don't care. You're not qualified anymore. Just go away. But people voted for him. And,
yeah.
You know, to me, it's like, you know, Nazi Germany, there were, you know, Hitler was popularly elected. He didn't usurp power. He was elected. So imagine somebody, a Nazi neighbor of a Jewish guy saying, well, you know, I have nothing against you. It's just I really like that guy's policies. I mean, would that work? And then if you look at, you know, who he surrounds himself by, a lot of these right-wing extremists like Sebastian Gorka and Michael Flynn, who is on the board of ACT, which is an anti-Muslim hate group, which says that the only good Muslim is a dead Muslim, and, you know, Muslims are the only people who can't be citizens. I mean, that's not good. That's terrible, you know. And this type of paranoia and fear, this is what did it to people. These politics, you know, because so many of my neighbors, they're so good and they're so kind. These are the type of people who would give you the shirts off their back. And really, I mean, so many of them are far better than me. And it took me a long time to reconcile, well, why would they vote for this guy? You know, why would they do that? And it was fear. It was that fear. And you and I know that, you know, the limbic system, which processes fear, can shut off the prefrontal cortex, which is where you get, you know, executive function and reasoning from, because it just kind of overpowers it. And that's what happened. And I think Trump knew that. I think he knew what he was doing.
I want to ask you about one more really poignant moment in the book where you have three children. I think, I don't remember their exact ages, fairly young, although it seems like maybe your oldest child is a son who's, I guess, maybe a teenager now or something.
Yeah.
But I don't know if this was him, but it's Faisal says, can't we just pretend we're not Muslim at one of the scenes in the book? How did you handle that?
Yeah, so Faisal came in, I think, several days after the election. I don't remember the exact date, but he said, Dad, can't we just pretend we're not Muslim so we can stay in Dawson? That just breaks your heart because you want to stay in Dawson and you want to be yourself, be your identity. So I didn't have any words. I just actually walked away. I didn't say anything back to him. And, you know, Faisal is a tough case to begin with. He has high functioning autism, so it's hard enough for him to just fit in because he's got some social awkwardness to him. Wonderful, beautiful son. But, you know, this, we didn't need this on top of, you know, the other struggles that we have to go through.
Mm. Dr. Virgie, I want to like shift gears a little bit and congratulate you on this book and the work that you're doing, because it really is meaningful and inspiring people really at this point, all not just across rural America, but all across America, as I have now heard about your story. You have this specialty in obesity and, in fact, I guess have written a previous book about you know, how to lose weight. And then there's, I understand from your book, this company Body Togs, which, if I understand, is like this pretty interesting idea to me. It was like it goes back a ways, but wearing weights around your ankles to try to, when you walk, you know, to just sort of burn more calories or something. Or tell us how you became interested in obesity and what some of your methods are.
When I was a resident at Duke and I saw my first pediatric diabetic patient. She was a 12-year-old girl, and she was diabetic, and she was obese. And I was a resident at that time. I didn't have the guts to go tell her, listen, you're a diabetic, change her life, and just kind of destroy her heart like that. So I referred her to an endocrinologist because I couldn't do that. And that was one of my sentinel events that I said, you know what, I'm going to do something about this too. And so I became passionate about obesity medicine, and I started reading as much as I possibly could. I read about all the adipkinds and leptin and different medications, lipogenic medications that are common, et cetera, and developed my own diet, which has been phenomenal. It's just worked very well. The idea for Body Togs came while I was studying for my obesity medicine board exam. This was when I was in Florida, and I just thought of these anatomically designed wearable weights, which just wrapped around like the gastric, nemus, and soleus muscle on the legs, so you wouldn't even feel them. And if you just put them on and you just walked and you just did your daily activities, you'd go to work, run errands, shopping, whatever you do, and you take them off when you get home, and it's equivalent to a 2-mile run. And that's what we found as far as studies go. We've done now 3 studies on the Body Togs, and then we've done 3 studies on the diet, which is phenomenal. And here in Dawson, we have probably about 5,000 pounds of weight loss doing this for about 3 or 4 years. So the diet is the Body Togs diet. It's a grocery store diet. You can get everything over the counter, and we give it to everybody for free. You don't have to buy it. It's on the website, bodytogs.com. And I use that, and I have a nutritionist with me also, and then I have a team of a couple nurse practitioners, and we work together seeing patients, helping them with obesity and obesity-related comorbidities.
So one of the patients that you did write about in the book in regard to this was one of your success stories who was, I think, a surgeon. He had pulmonary fibrosis. So he was, going to have a lung surgery or was it bariatric surgery? But the surgeon decided that they weren't going to do the surgery unless this person could lose 80 pounds. And he came to you and he sort of got the gospel and he lost 10 pounds the first month. And then he became sort of your emblematic patient because... Is it a program that allows you to lose weight? I know the answer to this one, but you can't return to your normal or your previous habits. You got to kind of maintain, don't you?
Yeah. So basically the diet, we describe it as 80% knowledge and 20% effort. So there's a lot of interesting, scientific information beyond just macronutrients and micronutrients, but data on the salience of food, portion versus serving size, surface area to volume ratio of nutrients and their effect on things like the glycemic index, the insulin index, which is, non-carbohydrate-containing foods' ability to stimulate insulin and what have you. So we kind of put all of that together, I call it the multidimensional nutritional analysis technique, into a very simple diet. And there's four categories. Category one, eat as much as you want, whenever you want. Category two, two servings a day. Category four, two servings a day. And that's it. And there's a supplement that we recommend, a body talk supplement, that they use along this, and they lose weight. So this particular patient you're talking about is doing phenomenal. He's down, I think his last count was 87 pounds, and his lung function so good, he doesn't need the surgery. He still hasn't needed the surgery.
That was the best part, right? He had this terrible lung condition, autoimmune lung condition, and he wound up not needing the surgery because just losing the weight made him feel so much better and improve his lung function, which was, I guess you pointed out, a pretty rare thing to happen.
Yeah, we're so happy about that. And he's not even our biggest loser. Our biggest loser is probably around 130 pounds or so. But he is definitely one of our happy success stories.
Well, so I'm curious, your family has moved overseas, and you have taken a different job in Abu Dhabi, where you work for New York University School of Medicine or a program that they have in the Middle East. But then you commute back and forth. So was that part of sort of the journey with sort of the book and the, hate speech you were experiencing?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's ironic, actually, because we first decided we were going to move, and then we decided No, we're going to stick this out. We're just going to keep doing these talks. We're going to stay here. And I wasn't looking for a position. And then it was like, I think a year later, after all of this had happened, NYU and Abu Dhabi called me and said, hey, listen, we really like your CV. We'd really like to talk to you about coming and directing our health center here. I wasn't even thinking about it at that. It was so, coincidental almost. And then I'd done a few interviews and, they really liked it, really liked me. They thought I could do a lot for their health center there in Abu Dhabi. And then, my wife and I talked about it, I think every day, probably multiple hours every day, is this something, that we want to do? And then we kind of settled on the idea that, we do want to reconnect with family, and we've been away from family for a long time. And my family is over there, and so is a lot of her family. And we do want to reconnect, maybe with everything that happened, recently, with our own roots in Kenya and Tanzania, because I'm from Kenya. I was born in what Donald Trump would call an S-hole country, but I was born there, and my wife was born in Tanzania. And, from there you can really connect, and then we're, of course, ethnically Indian. So we decided maybe for our kids that would be the best thing for us now. So then we decided, but we didn't want to leave Dawson. I still feel Dawson is home, and I still want to practice here. We've done so much with the weight loss program. We get referrals from all over, from Minneapolis. I even have somebody who drives from Kansas to see me. So we wanted that to continue to grow. So then I decided I would do fall and spring over there, and then summer and winter time over here.
The name of the book is Love Thy Neighbor, A Muslim Doctor's Struggle for Home in Rural America. And it's by my guest today, Dr. Ayaz Virgi, who is a family doctor both in Dawson, Minnesota, and in Abu Dhabi. Dr. Virgi, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. If you've missed any of our shows, you can stream them online anytime on a smartphone, tablet, or a computer. Just go to our website, studiotulsa.org. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.